When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Oh, get on.
I left my home in Norfolk, Virginia, California, home of mine. I straddled that Greyhound and rode him into Raleigh and on across Carolina. I had more to trouble to turn into a struggle halfway across Alabama. Well, the town broke down and left us all stranded in downtown.
This is Kim Wright, and you're listening to Rock is Lit.
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 You're listening to Rock is Lit with Christy Halberg. Rock on, Christy.
Is lit.
Hey, lit listeners. Thanks for tuning in to Rock is Lit, the first and still only podcast devoted to rock novels, and also the 2024 American Writing Awards Podcast of the Year in the categories of music and arts. Rock is Lit is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network.
Hi, this is Jimmy Kimmel, and you're listening to Pantheon Podcast.
Rock is Lit is hosted, produced, and edited by me, Christy Alexander Halberg, author of my own rock novel, Searching for Jimmy Page. Special shout out to this semester's Rock is Lit interns, production intern Cater Jones, and social media intern Jenna Rudolph. Find out more about me and Rock is Lit on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube at Christy Halberg. Visit my website at ChristyAlexanderHalberg.com. And for goodness sakes, subscribe, comment, leave a 5-star rating and all that good stuff on your podcast platform of choice. Wyatt, the Rock is Lit mascot, and I thank you for your support.
Ladies and gentlemen, the show starts in 3, 2, 1.
In the first segment of episode 53, we're exploring the heart of the South with a literary journey that's as soulful as it is adventurous. Joining us is the award-winning author Kim Wright, whose novel Last Ride to Graceland takes us on a road trip filled with mystery, music, and the enduring legacy of Elvis Presley. Kim Wright is the author of Love in Mid-Air, The Unexpected Waltz, The Canterbury Sisters, Longest Day of the Year, and Last Ride to Graceland, which won the Willie Morris Award for Southern Fiction. She offers developmental editing as the story doctor and teaches creative writing workshops throughout the Southeast. Kim lives in Charlotte, where her hobbies include working with rescue dogs and competitive ballroom dancing. In Last Ride to Graceland, blues musician Corey Beth Ainsworth is barely scraping by after her mother's death when she discovers a priceless piece of rock and roll memorabilia hidden away in a shed out back of the family's coastal South Carolina home, the car Elvis Presley drove the day he died. A backup singer for the King, Corey's mother, Laura Honey Berry, was at Graceland that fateful day in August 1977. She quickly returned home to Beaufort and married her high school sweetheart. Yearning to uncover the secrets of her mother's past and possibly her own identity, Corey decides to drive the car back to Memphis and turn it over to Elvis's estate, retracing the exact route her mother took 37 years earlier. As she winds her way through the sprawling Deep South with its quaint towns and long stretches of open road, the burning question in Corey's mind, "Is Elvis Presley my father?" takes a back seat to the truth she learns about her complicated mother, the minister's daughter who spent a lifetime struggling to conceal the consequences of a single year of rebellion. Coming up, Kim and I will delve into the inspiration behind Last Ride to Graceland and the fascinating journey of research and discovery that brought the book to life. Stay tuned for the final segment of the episode when Stephanie Myers of Song Facts Podcast joined Rock is Lit Season 3 production intern Cater Jones and me for a chat about some of the real-life folks who have claimed to be Elvis's love children. But first, Rock is Lit welcomes Kim Wright to the podcast. Hi, Kim. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
I'm happy to be here.
I gave a quickie bio for you in the introduction to the episode, but tell me a little bit more about yourself. You've made Charlotte, North Carolina, your home. Were you born there, or do you have roots elsewhere in the South?
I was actually born here, which is so weird. Charlotte is one of those New South boom cities, and I don't think that there are a handful of people. I went to a cookout one time, and there were like 70 people there, and they said, "How many are native Charlottians?" And there were like three of us. It's a very rare thing to have lived in Charlotte your entire life, but I really do love it here. And I started out in journalism. I was a journalism major and a nonfiction writer for really the bulk of my career. I was in my 50s when I wrote my first novel. And basically, I had the most wonderful job in the world. I was a food, wine, and travel writer.
Sweet.
I was sweet. And I never would have given that up if basically almost all critique for all those things went to peer critique online. And my industry just kind of dried up like in a 2 to 3 year period. All the travel and food magazines, most of them kind of went under really quickly, and all the websites and everything kind of turned to peer review. So like a lot of nonfiction writers, I'd always really wanted to write a novel. So I was like in my mid-50s, kind of reinventing myself, going, well, I guess I'm a novelist now. But not, luckily, I tell my writing friends all the time, we're so lucky. We're not gymnasts. This is something you can do late in life.
Oh, yes.
As long as you still have half your marbles, you can still write. So, you know, it's a good late life career switch. But I switched to novels, which basically meant reinventing myself in terms of, you know, how everything is marketed, meeting other writers, which I think is huge. I always tell people that the thing that I most wish I could tell everybody that gets into the writing game is how important it is to have friends who are also writers in the same genre, doing basically the same thing, and how much you can help each other. And I kind of figured that out later than I wish I had. I wish I had been meeting people, networking, joining that world first. But like a lot of people, I didn't feel like I could do it until I had the criteria. You know, until I had like a published book, I'm kind of like, I can't start going to these conferences and talking to people. I haven't earned my way through the door. And that is so wrong. You need to do it early, and it helps so much. So almost all my friends now are writers, novelists. Yeah. It's hilarious.
Well, speaking of a support system, I have to give a shout out to Elaine Neal Orr, who first told me about your novel, Last Ride to Graceland. She had come to East Carolina University to give a reading. I think it was for her novel, Swimming Between Two Worlds. Mm-hmm. And we were at North Carolina Literary Review editor Margaret Bauer's house. And Margaret pulled Elaine over and said, "Christy has a novel. She's looking for a publisher. Talk to her. Give her some advice." And one of the things that Elaine said to me was, "Read Kim Wright's novel. Because it sounds like you're touching on some of the same themes that are in that book. And it's a very good book."
So I did, and I loved it, and I just read it again because we're going to be talking about it. And you were kind enough to give me a blurb for my book right before it came out. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Oh, you are welcome. But see, that's the sort of thing. I wish I had been able to talk to people that were writing similar books while I was writing mine.
Mm-hmm.
But I think 90% of writers just kind of toil away absolutely alone, not really realizing how much community does. So, yeah, that's my only advice. Just, you know, pluck yourself up and start going to these things, you know, library events, conferences, whatever, wherever you think you'll meet other writers, workshops, whatever, and talk to people. It's a huge, helpful thing. And Elaine is a doll. That doesn't surprise me in the least. She's a very nice person.
She absolutely is. Well, before we jump into our discussion of Last Ride to Graceland, would you read an excerpt from the book?
Sure. I really thought I would just read the beginning of it because I think it's a very voice-driven book. And for that reason, it doesn't need much of a setup. You can just kind of go in it because you've immediately got Corey Beth's voice. So
mm-hmm.
I'll just read the first two or three pages and we'll kind of talk about it from there.
This is Kim Wright reading from her award-winning novel, Last Ride to Graceland.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama. Any way you do.
I was a premature baby who weighed 9 pounds and 9 ounces. Yeah, I know. Impossible. But you have to understand that this particular type of miracle is common in the rural South. Jesus still looks down from billboards around here, and people still care what their neighbors think. We pray, and we salute, and most of all, we lie. It's why we have so many good writers per capita, and so many bad writers too, because all of us learned how to bend the truth before we could even half talk. This may sound bad until you consider that most people only lie to protect something they love, like their family, or their dignity, or their reputation. A sense of decorum can be a good thing. In fact, I don't think the world has enough of it. I remember my grandmother crying when she took me to a touring show of Fiddler on the Roof in Savannah, wiping her eyes when they sang Tradition and saying, "That's my life, Corey Beth. That's my life up and down," except for that part where they're Jewish. So imagine yourself in a version of Fiddler on the Roof where the traditions involve tying rice up in little pink net packages before you throw them at the bride, hiding the dark meat at the bottom of the chicken salad so the ladies in the prayer circle won't think you're trash. Sending birthday gifts to people you can't stand because they sent you one back in 1997 and now neither one of you knows how to break the cycle. That's right. Imagine yourself in a very polite, insane asylum. Then you'll have some sense of how I grew up. Beaufort, South Carolina is the old South. Not like Atlanta with its hip hop or Charlotte with its banks, or Florida with Walt Disney and all those serial killers. That's a whole different world. That's the part of the South that more or less won the war, and people forget that the rest of us even exist. We're just a place they drive through on their way to somewhere else. When they're forced to stop for something, gas or firecrackers or barbecue or watermelon, they get back in their car and shake their heads and go, "Can you believe that?" They think we're slow, but we're not really slow. We just take longer to get there. We meander and backtrack and beat around the bush, which I guess you think is what I'm doing now. But I do have a point, and here it comes. Saying that I was born 7 months and 4 days after my parents got married is just one way to figure the math. Another way is to say I was born 7 months and 9 days after my mama left Graceland, driving home in some madcap rush because she suddenly realized out of nowhere that she'd made a mistake. Maybe she shouldn't have gone on the road as a backup singer. Maybe she shouldn't have dyed her hair and lined her eyes and chased the bright lights of rock and roll. Maybe she should have stayed home and married the local boy, the one who loved her so bad he asked her to marry him on the very night they graduated from Leland Howie High. She couldn't see then that her true destiny was standing right in front of her. She was 18, and she had something to prove. So Laura Berry left Beaufort, and when the door slammed behind her, it slammed right on Bradley Ainsworth's heart. She toured, and he waited, tinkering his life away in the family concrete business until that day in the late summer of 1977, when it was so hot that the air shimmered, and he looked up thinking at first it was the sweat in his eyes that deceived him. But no, there she truly was, Laura, the love of his life, walking towards him across the lawn. The makeup was wiped off her face, the boots were gone, and the leather jacket too, and her hair was pulled back, plain as truth, and her arms were stretched out before her like she was some sort of sleepwalker. She was sorry, she told him, so very sorry. She'd seen the world, and she'd seen enough. She left Memphis and driven straight through the night, crying and praying and drinking truck stop coffee just to keep herself going. All she knew was that she had to get home. Would he still have her? Was it too late? In answer, he picked her up and swung her around, swung her in a big circle. And when she tried to apologize again, he told her to hush, that year that they spent apart had never happened. She was his girl, always had been, and there was no need to talk about it any other way. They'd get married the very next day with her daddy in the pulpit and the whole town in the pews. And then the rest of their lives would come spooling out like silk, one sweet thing following another, just like they'd planned. 7 months and 4 days later, there I was, so big and strong that everybody always claimed I lifted my head and looked right at Laura and Bradley in the living room, as if I was trying to say, really? You're both sure? This is the version of the story we decided to go with? Bradley Ainsworth is a good man. He nursed my mother when breast cancer took her, way too young, and he did all the things a father is supposed to do. I can still see him pushing the chalk machine that lined the soccer field in the elementary school, eating the Girl Scout cookies I was too shy to sell, scowling at my dates and asking if they thought they were good enough to take his baby girl to the dance. He lives simple and true. He votes Republican, and he sits on the session of the First Presbyterian Church of Beaufort. And I never want to hurt him, but math is math, and facts are the facts. And the truth is that the truth can only stay hidden for so long, even in the South. I've known it all my life, and it's time to do something about it. Most of the people I could hurt are dead, save for Bradley, and who knows, the truth might set him free too, just a little bit. Deep down inside, he's got to know it. He's got to know it as good as I do. And we may as well both take a deep breath and say it out loud. Elvis Presley is my real daddy.
Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train got my baby and gone.
This is Margaret Bauer, and you're listening to Rock Is Lit.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night, ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become? Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
I'm going to backtrack shortly and talk about inspiration and research and all that kind of thing. But I want to talk about sense of place.
Okay.
So let's talk about the South as a character in Last Ride to Graceland.
I've always thought sense of place was hugely important. I think it started with the fact I was a travel writer. So as a travel writer, my job was to describe a place. And you do that as a travel writer by going to the place and walking the streets and eating the food and listening to the music and talking to the people. There is no way you can research yourself into a sense of place, or at least I can't. I cannot write about a place until I've been there and done what I call the boots on the ground segment. I have never spent a lot of time in the deep, deep South. And so when I got this idea, and I got the idea Corey Beth is going to ultimately find the car that Elvis Presley drove on the last day of his life in a fishing shed that belonged to her parents and decided to drive it back to Graceland and get some answers. And she drives through the deep South. She goes through Alabama and Mississippi and comes up through Tupelo and into Memphis. And that was not really a part of the South I knew very well. So I took off and drove that route. The route that I describe in the book that Corey Beth drove in present day and her mother had driven in 1977. I like to say they took an old South story because they were in a big muscle car with a coon hound, and I drove it in a Prius with a Yorkshire Terrier. So mine was a little bit more of a New South journey, but I drove that route because I knew I couldn't make it up. And the details of the book are taken from my own trip. I mean, there really is a rest stop where I stopped outside of Macon, Georgia, where she found the dog. All of that stuff, I don't think I could have made it up. And Julia Cameron's got a great line about writing. She says it's not as much about making stuff up as it is about getting stuff down.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a lot of truth in that. You observe something and you get it on the paper. And it gives, I think, everything that follows a level of authenticity that if you don't get it right, nobody believes anything in the book. If you don't nail place, they don't believe the characters, they don't believe the dialogue, they don't believe the plot. But if you nail place and they feel like they're there and you weave in the kind of details about, like, you know, what's in an Elvis Presley milkshake or something, the reader begins to be seduced into what I call the world of the story.
Yeah.
And from that point on, they'll believe anything. You can tell them things that are rather far-fetched or ironic or whatever, and they'll go right along with you because they see the place. They feel they're there. So I think it's the entry point to the magic of story. In the sense, if you don't seduce the reader with place, it really doesn't matter what you do after that.
Kim, I think your writing so vividly captures that cultural landscape of the rural South. You've got the billboards featuring religious imagery to the unique atmosphere of Alabama. And I love that you write on page 94, and this is when Corey is on the road heading to Alabama. Here's a quote. "An exit is coming up, but it doesn't say anything about a town. It just promises strippers and Jesus. Two things that Alabama seems to offer an endless supply," end quote. And I'm fascinated by that juxtaposition between the profane and the sacred. It's just so interesting to me. But you captured that essence of the South in each part of the South.
The pieces of the South, I don't think people live outside the South really get this. If you're talking to editors in New York, they're like, oh, it's a Southern book. Well, is it Virginia Southern or Texas Southern or Florida Southern? Tennessee is nothing like Florida. New Orleans is not a whole lot like, you know, Savannah. All these things really kind of have their own flavor.
Yeah.
So, you know, as a Southerner, I'm kind of like, okay, but what part of the South are you talking about? Because if you're living in the Research Triangle of North Carolina, you're having an utterly different experience than somebody in deep Alabama is having. So I have to do the boots on the ground. I think that's the only way you get the detail or you can catch the flavor. You know, we've all been bopping down these interstates. You see these exits and all they've got is like they've got one place that's got the selling like fireworks and lingerie and, you know, a church. And that's the whole exit. So it's, you know, it's not like it's not real. It's just kind of funny. So I enjoyed that part of it. I literally kept a spiral bound notebook like you get at a CVS or something on the seat beside me. I was scribbling as I drove.
Speaking of Jesus and the strip joints, it reminded me of that Flannery O'Connor quote, "The Christ-haunted South."
Yes, yes, very much so. I love that quote.
Do you think that description relates to the novel?
Yeah, I mean, I really do. Because, I mean, I think somebody asked me a while back, what do I write about? And I said, I write about second chances.
Mm-hmm.
If I had to describe thematically what I write about, I write about second chances, which is another way of saying I write about redemption. And I really think people trying to reckon with the past or trying to find self-forgiveness or trying to find what I call redemptive lift, I think that's a huge thing, not just a Southern thing, but you can certainly see it in the South because I think the South wears its sins so open. And, you know, it wears its sins maybe more openly, sometimes to our detriment and sometimes to our blessing. I think that's an interesting theme. I can explore it in infinite ways, but all of my characters are trying to make peace with something. And so a lot of times trying to make peace with something involves going back, retracing your steps, going back to a previous part of your life, or maybe something that even happened before you were born, some kind of generational, intergenerational trauma. And I find that an endlessly fascinating subject, but it seems to be sort of linked to the South. Because, you know, the South has got the huge sin of slavery writ large across it. And I think it's been trying to find redemption from that, sometimes more successfully than others, now for decades upon decades upon decades. So, yeah, when she talks about Christ being everywhere, That's really true. Oh, have you heard of the Kudzu Jesus?
No.
Okay, he's not too far from you. There is a clump of kudzu that is hanging on a power line somewhere in the mountains, and it looks exactly like Jesus on the cross, and people make pilgrimages to see the kudzu Jesus.
Well, I'll be damned.
He's made out of kudzu. So if you want to see the true Christ haunted clap, make a pilgrimage to the, that's my advice to you, the kudzu Jesus.
Well, I hear there are actually still snake handling churches out here in Western North Carolina. I've never been to one. That would be interesting.
I've actually been to a snake handling revival.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, Asheville's interesting because Asheville's so urbane and liberal and cultured. You know, you drive 20 miles in any direction, all kinds of stuff. You start hearing those banjos from Deliverance.
Well, you just kind of answered my question then. I was going to say, do you think the South in general is still Christ haunted?
Yeah, I mean, I really do. And here's another element. What I think is probably the single biggest thing in the Southern voice, if there is a Southern voice, and taking into account what we were just talking about the South's got a lot of different regions. But I think the Southern voice is confessional. It has this really intimate, and I think because it is born from an oral storytelling tradition. My grandfather was a fantastic storyteller. Like, he would start these long, complicated stories with 50 characters, and somehow he'd weave it all together at the end. He was doing it orally. That's sort of a gift, but it's a really Southern thing to have this kind of implied, pull up your rocking chair, I'm going to tell you something. And I'm only telling this to you, and let me drop my voice, because this is a secret, and I'm going to confess it to you. And I think a lot of times, Southern fiction, one of the things that marks it is not just that it's set in the South or that has certain themes, because you can say, well, what do Southerners write about? Well, they write about forgiveness and family and faith and, you know, race. Everybody writes about those things. There's nothing instinctively Southern about any of those things. But I think the really big thing that Southern fiction often has is this very conversational quality. And what makes it Southern is not what it's about, but how it's told.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this rambling conversational style that I think if it's done well, should sound like human speech. It should sound like you're actually hearing a story being told to you. So to me, that's what Southern is, that voice, that conversational voice.
7 lonely days and 12 pounds ago, I reached out one night and you were gone. Don't know why you'd run, what you're running to or from. All I know, I want to bring you home. So I'm walking in the rain, thumbing for a ride on this lonely Kentucky back road. I've loved you much too.
Well, let's pivot back up to inspiration, because this is a great story. And you said that the inspiration for the novel came after reading an article about the car Elvis Presley drove on the last day of his life. And there's this very famous photo that you can find online that captures that moment. It's kind of grainy, but you can see him in the car. Tell me more about that article, that moment where you were reading the paper and you thought, I have a story.
Well, it was a Sunday morning and I was actually looking at the Charlotte Observer. So I'm flipping through the local section and Last Ride to Graceland was actually the title of the article, which I thought immediately was an evocative title. So I was flipping through and I'm like, Last Ride to Graceland. And what it was about was they were redoing the garage at Graceland and they came across, they knew it was there, but nobody had looked at it for years. The car that Elvis drove on the morning that he died. And what had happened was Elvis didn't do anything like a normal person. He went to the dentist in the middle of the night, which is a scene I imagine and put in the novel. Because if he went out in the middle of the day in Memphis, he'd be mobbed. So he did all of his shopping, all of his stuff. He'd go to the dentist at like 4 in the morning. They'd just keep the dentist office for him. And that's what he did that morning. He went with a couple of his backup singers to the dentist. And the last picture taken of him alive was driving through the gates of Graceland about 4 in the morning in this car. And when he died a few hours later, they knew the car was valuable. It was like the last thing he touched. And they just wrapped it in bubble wrap and taped it together. I mean, it was, you know, it's the most inefficient thing you can imagine. You can just imagine a bunch of people in a panic, you know, taking duct tape and bubble wrap and just wrapping up this enormous black car, which they've now got on display at Graceland. Then they found it during the garage expansion. And here's the sentence that made me really want to write this book. The guy said when he cut open the bubble wrap and opened the door, it was like opening a time machine.
Yeah.
That line just kind of really got my writer juices going, because he said it still smelled like Elvis. It still had a whiff of his cologne in it. I mean, you know, by now, you know, it's like 26 years later.
That's amazing.
There was a styrofoam cup in the cup holder with a woman's kind of cherry red lipstick imprint on it. And there was this trash from a fast food place. In other words, the story of his last day was in that car.
Yeah.
So I was intrigued by that. I'm like, okay, that's so interesting. You could work your way backwards and figure out everything that had happened that day.
Mm-hmm.
And so I begin to imagine a girl who is the daughter of one of Elvis's backup singers. But her mother never talked about her one wild year. She toured with Elvis for 1 year, came home, married her high school sweetheart, sang in the church choir, never mentioned it again, but then she died of breast cancer. And her daughter, sent by her dad, who was not her biological dad, but the wonderful man her mother married, goes out to their fishing cabin, finds the car, and decides she's going to drive it back to Graceland and try and get some answers about what happened to her mother. So following the trail of clues that are basically the trash in the car, she tries to recreate the drive her mother made in 1977 in reverse. And it was really hard to write because it's a split narrative of her mother, Honey, driving west to east in 77 and Corey Beth driving east to west all those years later. But it was really fun. It was a really fun challenge. And she makes like five stops along the way. But it all really came out of that article. And the reason it was in Charlotte paper, this is pretty interesting too, is no one had ever driven that car but Elvis. And they didn't want anybody to ever drive that car from Elvis. So they pushed it onto a tractor trailer. This is like the cult of Elvis. They push it on a tractor trailer and take it to Charlotte so the NASCAR Museum can restore it. And it's never still to this day been driven by anybody but Elvis. They pushed it on a thing, took it to Charlotte, pushed it back off. NASCAR people worked on it, pushed it back on a thing, took it back to Memphis, pushed it off, and now it's in the museum. So when I finally got to Graceland at the end of this long trip, you know, I'm going through, and Graceland's not that big. That's one of the weird things. You know, Graceland's no, there's, you know, 1,000 houses in my neighborhood that are bigger than Graceland's just not that big. So, but I get there, but they've opened this huge part. Garage out back with all of Elvis's cars in it. And in the most position of honor, literally up on this pedestal, is this black Stutz Blackhawk that he drove on the morning that he died, with a big grainy blow up of that picture of him driving it just a few hours before his death. And so I'm standing there staring at it so long that this security guard at Graceland kind of notices me. And, you know, of course, I'm taking a picture of everything that moves at Graceland and, you know, all this. I mean, I really try to do heavy research while I'm at Graceland, and I keep breaking away from the tour. So I think they were already thinking I was up to no good. And I said, I'm writing a book. And I said, this car features in the book. And they literally had it roped off with those velvet ropes like they used to have at the movies.
Yeah.
And he said, well, would you like to come closer? And I'm like, yes, absolutely. Because the door of the car is open. You can see the interior. So he very grandly unhooks this velvet rope, takes me up the steps, and I look at the car. And it's amazing because it was fitted with 24-karat gold features because, you know, he was Elvis. But gold is soft, so, like, the gear shift and everything had the imprints of his fingers in it.
Oh, my god!
Because the gold was malleable under his – and the steering wheel was outlaid in gold, but it had his handprints on it.
That's amazing.
But he just gripped right through the gold, and I was just, like, flipping out. And I said, oh, can I sit in it? And the guy said, no. Okay, I went a bridge. I wasn't trying to drive it. I thought maybe they'd let me sit in it because, you know, at some point somebody said
you had to try.
I had gone a bridge too far. I was scooting down those steps and hustled back to my tour group. But I mean, I got pretty up close and personal in the car, which is important because if you're talking about the South being a character, that car is really a character in the book.
Oh, absolutely.
So it was good to have a little close glance at the car. That was pretty funny.
I've been to Graceland, but it's been a very long time. I was driving home, doing a solo drive from the Bay Area in California back home to Eastern North Carolina, to Greenville. And one of the stops was Graceland because I've been an Elvis fan all my life, really. And you're right. I was expecting something massive, but it's not that big.
No.
It's really not that big, but it's fascinating.
The Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar. I am following the river down the highway through the cradle of the Civil War. I'm going to Graceland, Graceland, to Memphis, Tennessee. I'm going to Graceland.
Did you know a lot about cars before you wrote the book? Because I'll tell you what impressed me, because I don't know a dipstick from a gear shift. And the details in the book about how they get it running after sitting there in that shed all those years was impressive.
Well, that I actually got some help with. I'm lucky in the sense that Charlotte's got the NASCAR Museum. So I actually went and talked to the guy who restored the car.
Wow.
And said, what'd you have to do to restore the car? So that was easy research in the sense it was like 10 miles down the road from me to go and talk to this guy. Because, yeah, you could put what I know about vintage muscle cars in a thimble. I don't know anything about it. I didn't even know much about Elvis. People assume I was a big Elvis fan. This whole thing kind of came on me as a rush. Through the research, I became a bigger Elvis fan. He's had a really fascinating, interesting life. But I didn't start out like, whoa, I'm really going to write a book about music or Elvis or cars. None of that was on the radar. It just kind of all came together based on that one article I looked at in The Observer.
Okay, so you didn't grow up listening to Elvis?
No,
this was not in your house?
No, I was a Beatles girl.
All right. I love the Beatles too, but Santa Claus brought me one of Elvis's greatest hits, the Christmas right after he died when I was 7 years old. And so I've been a fan ever since. But however, I've been an even bigger Beatles fan since I was 10.
Well, it's kind of funny. Somebody sent me, there was actually an article she found about they found Paul McCartney's original guitar. Kind of in the same way. And she's like, maybe you can make a whole career out of objects that are found from famous people.
That's your next novel.
I know. She's like, they think you can do a sequel. But but I think that's kind of funny. You know, the certain relics, I think, have a certain power. And that car, even not as an Elvis fan, I saw that car had a certain iconic power.
And I want to talk more about Elvis, but let's talk about Corey Beth and her mother, Laura Honey Berry. Before we get to him, that these are both women who are singers with complex backgrounds. So can you share the inspiration behind these characters and their musical journey? Are you a singer? Did you grow up a preacher's kid? Any of that?
No, God knows. If you heard me sing, you would know I'm not kidding you about that. I'm not a singer by any stretch of the imagination. I didn't grow up a preacher's kid. I did grow up in the South as a good Presbyterian girl, but that's about the extent of that. Basically, the way I got the idea for Honey, she's Laura, but they call her Honey. Elvis calls her Honey. So during her touring year at Graceland, her name is Honey. One of the things that was super interesting to me, and this goes a little bit into Elvis, is that they think one of the reasons he was so successful is his music was a fusion of black and white music. And he was maybe the first artist to do that. And he really loved and followed like the blues and jazz and kind of the black indigenous late, you know, kind of deep South Southern music, and would go to black churches because he loved the gospel. But he often also went to white churches because he loved the gospel, and he loved rockabilly and country music too. So they said his sound was a fusion of all of the above. And he was maybe the first person to fuse black and white music. And this is illustrated, I think, in this fascinating story. I talked to a guy who was a DJ in Memphis during the time they were releasing Elvis's first music. But when he went into Sun Records and started singing, they didn't know what to do with him because he was a white boy who sounded black. So like, what do you do with a white person who sounds black? I mean, this is in the 50s in the South, deep South. And so they had him cut a record, and it had a white side and a black side. I'm using their terms. They put a white friendly song on one side and release it to all the radio stations in the South, telling them which side to listen to. And both sides went to number one.
Mm.
And they're like, okay, we got something different here. His sound is equally popular with black and white. So in honor of his musical roots, and I don't want to paint him as some sort of ahead of his time racial saint, because he was not, but he certainly respected the black tradition. And in honor of the fact his music had dual roots, he always had black backup singers on stage with him. And Mary Lee is based on those women. The black backup singers were usually in their 40s and 50s and started on the gospel circuit. And they were experienced tourists. I mean, they had toured for years, experienced backup singers. And so he had them on one side. On the other side, he would get these young white girls, as he liked super young, innocent, virginal girls.
Yes, we know this.
Mostly recruited them from like church choirs and stuff. And they were his backup singers with the teased hair and the 60s look. And, you know, what we think of as like the, you know, the Priscilla look, you know.
Yeah.
But he always had the black backup singers and the white backup singers behind him in honor of the two traditions of his music. So I created Honey out of how they recruited those girls. And these girls were from tiny towns in the South. And most of them had grown up singing like in, you know, high school chorus groups or the church choir or something. They were like 17, 18, 19 years old. They'd never been out of the sticks. Now they're touring with Elvis and living in Vegas. And you can imagine the degree of culture shock somebody like Honey, being a preacher's daughter from South Carolina, would have when all of a sudden she's living in Graceland. And apparently the older black women kind of took these girls under their wing, as Merrily kind of takes Honey. Once I heard those two stories, the characters of Merrily, I knew I wanted one of each, one of the older black women who had really been around the block with Elvis and wouldn't take any of his crap. And somebody like Honey, who had never been out of her backyard and was just shell-shocked by the whole thing. I knew I wanted those two characters at Graceland. It was easy to come up with Honey based on those girls. There's an incredible picture in Graceland that I took. That's the entire entourage, the entire touring entourage. And you see the five or six black women standing and the five or six white girls with their teased, you know, black lips and all that standing. And I just thought, okay, that's Merrily and Honey standing together in that picture. So once I came up with Honey, I thought, okay, she would have been a person of her era who wanted to be a singer. But how are you a singer when you grow up singing, you know, in your daddy's church choir? And then you go to Graceland and you see a seamy, seedy underbelly of the music industry. You're kind of a little used and abused. You flee home and marry your childhood sweetheart, and you just vow to never talk about it. But guess what? Your daughter's a singer too, and she wants to tour. And so Corey Beth was obviously of a different generation, and she's more of a Joni Mitchell type, folky type singer, but her voice sounds just like her mother. And one of the things I kind of enjoyed doing with it is Corey Beth grew up rebellious, the anti-Laura, didn't want to be like her mom. Her mom just turned into such a church lady. She's got this one hidden year in her past she won't talk about. Other than that, she's just lived on the straight and narrow for all these years. So Corey Beth is like, I'm nothing like my mother. And as she takes this trip back, everybody's like, oh my God, you're like Laura made over.
Yes.
You look just like her. You sound just like her. That's what I mean about redemption. I think it's hard for women to face that eventually we all turn into our mothers. So I think poor Corey is trying so hard not to be Laura that I just enjoyed having everybody she met along the trail say she looked and sounded just like her mom. You know, Corey Beth was of a generation, she had a lot of options that Laura didn't have.
Yeah. But her life is also going nowhere at the beginning of the novel. She's 37 years old. She plays in these bars, and whenever she can get a gig, she's got financial trouble. So she's at a point in her life where she's kind of ripe for the picking in terms of going out and having an adventure and trying to do a little soul searching.
Well, one of the really interesting things that you have to do when you're writing a book where somebody hits the road is you've got to have that person at a point in their life where they can take the road trip because they don't have anything to lose.
Yeah.
You've got to kind of have them at a point. And Corey doesn't have anything to lose. She didn't have a family. She didn't have a regular job. She sings at kind of a shrimp bar dive along the waterfront. She can find this car and take off.
Mm-hmm.
She can do that. And so it was good for me to have her a little bit of a loser so that she would just go and do this. And then also one of the hardest things, if you want a character to really get lost and go back in time, one of the hardest technical things, and I've done this in three books, is you got to figure out a way to get rid of their cell phones, because people cannot be that lost, or they can't be that alone with their thoughts, or they can't be in a situation where they have to talk to strangers as long as they have that fill in the blank phone in their head. And so I had her phone turned off for non-service. She's so broke, you know, she gets in this car with basically what she's got in her pocket and takes off. So I kind of had to break her down a little bit to get her to that point. But also like the idea that, you know, a lot of creative people, God knows it happens to writers too, are not making a fortune. They are working dive bars.
Oh, yeah.
Most singers live like Corey Bethlehem.
They call me poor boy, poor boy.
Don't go away. We'll be back in a moment with more Kim Wright. And stick around for the final segment of the episode when Song Facts host Stephanie Myers and Rock is Lit Season 3 production intern Cater Jones join the party to talk about some actual alleged Elvis love children. You don't want to miss this.
Can't buy a joke, can't pay the rent. I got a heart full of dreams and a lot of...
This is Michael Parker, and you're listening to Rock is Lit.
Throughout the novel, music plays a significant role. From Corey Best singing to the influence of Elvis, of course. Are there any specific songs or style of music that inspired or accompanied you during the writing process?
Well, I really, for that drive, obviously I made a mix of Elvis music. But I also made a mix of kind of the origins of what Elvis drew from. Specifically, I didn't know anything about rockabilly. So I went back to that. I got early Sun Record compilation tapes and listen to them. And it really is kind of fascinating. It's really good music to drive through the South with. So it was the soundtrack. I thought I should release that book with a soundtrack.
Well, that's what people do now.
I know, but that was a little ahead of my time on that, because I said there really are some certain songs that I would kind of like. And, you know, and then also the black gospel music that he used to sneak out. And I mean, supposedly he would sit in the back row of black churches, listen to the black gospel. So I thought we could have a heck of a soundtrack for this book.
Did you have any trouble balancing the fictional Elvis in the story with the actual Elvis? Taking that research that you came across and blending that into the fictional world that you created?
I've got this rule for research. A, I do less of it than most writers that I know. And B, I only research what I need to know for the novel. I do not do a lot of research and draw the novel from it, because I have seen too many times, and I now teach writing. I think this is a huge trap people fall into. They say, I want to do a book based on a time period or based on a real person. And they go to town and they do a score of research. And then the problem with that is, they fall in love with the facts, they've got all this research, and they become absolutely hell-bent in working every single one of those details and sub-stories into the book. And you end up not having a novel, you end up having a compilation of facts strung together with a little bit of a narrative. And I've seen this happen so many times, I think people can become lost in their research, and you can never do enough of it. So I thought, I'm going to write this as pure fiction, I'm going to make it a mother-daughter story. And I'm only going to research what I need to know. So I wrote the book and then went back and did the research I needed to support things I'd already put in the book. So the facts of the book do not come out of the research. The research is there to support the story that I wrote originally with no research.
Okay. Did you have to change anything once you did the research?
Yeah. The bad side of that is that you realize you get some things wrong and you have to change. It wasn't anything so major that it was an arduous change. And I have seen too many people, I see it now, a lot of my students now write historical fiction. I'm like, at some point, you have got to stop researching. You are never going to be able to write this book. You can have too much research. You can know too many facts and be unable to tell a story about it. And people don't buy fiction for facts. We learn a lot through fiction. They buy fiction for story. And I think sometimes the story can just drown under the weight of the facts.
Let's talk a little bit about not facts so much as some of the myths and the controversies and the rumors surrounding Elvis, because you play around with them a little bit in the story. You use this quote from Bruce Springsteen as the epigraph of the novel. Here's the quote. It was like he came along and whispered some dream in everybody's ear, and somehow we all dreamed it, end quote.
Yeah.
And that captures Elvis's mythic status. It is, yes. And so many of the artists, the rockers of that period, of Bruce Springsteen's period, John Lennon, the Beatles, everybody loved Elvis at that point.
Right.
So speaking of the Elvis myth, there's a press conference that Elvis gives in the early 70s that I immediately thought of when I was crafting questions for this and thinking about, how am I going to talk about Miss? What do I want to talk about? And my brain went back to that 1972 press conference he gave.
Are you satisfied with the image you've established?
Well, the image is one thing, and a human being is another, you know.
How close is the image to the man?
It's very hard to live up to an image. I've heard it that way.
Let's talk about some of the myths, rumors, et cetera, surrounding Elvis, especially the ones that crept into the novel.
Yeah, I mean, I think it all comes back to one fact about Elvis's life that I found endlessly fascinating. The two things about Elvis I find most interesting, the honoring of the black and white musical tradition is item right. number one. The second one was he was a twin. He had an identical twin who died at birth.
Yeah.
And I personally believe that he spent his entire life searching for his missing twin.
That's actually a quote from the novel on page 121.
Yeah.
And I think Marilee says, yeah. or somebody says, Elvis spent a lifetime searching for his twin.
Well, I mean, because when I got to Tupelo, where his infant brother is still buried, and I find that very mysterious. I mean, when you get to Graceland, all the graves are practically like shrines. His father's grave, his mother's grave, all the graves there are certainly his. Are shrines. They left his infant twin brother in Tupelo in this neglected, weedy, nothing little highway flying by cemetery. Why was he not moved there? I think that's so strange. So I had Marilee go, part of him is still back in Tupelo. And I think that number one, there was a sense of something missing. He had a lifetime fear of being alone. He never did anything alone. He never slept a night alone in his life that anybody knows. His mother slept with him until he went to the army. He had a terror of being alone, but he also at times would talk to his missing twin. I think he had a sort of survivor's guilt. Why did one baby die and one baby live? It made his parents, it made him an only child. The birth was so difficult. His mother never had any more children, made her obsessed with him, which is, I think, part of what happened too. And he was very much a mama's boy to a truly stunning degree. But I also think that it's part of why he had this weird habit. This to me was fascinating, of he wanted everyone to look like him. And Priscilla looks a lot like him. Priscilla could be his sister. I mean, they say that he was love at first sight because she had similar features. Well, many people think the absolute love of his life, more than Priscilla, was Anne Margaret.
Anne Margaret, yeah.
Who looks, if Anne Margaret had jet black hair, she'd look just like Elvis.
And she had his energy.
Yes. I think that's a fascinating part of the story. That didn't really come into the novel. But when they worked together, that was the closest he came, I think, from what I can understand, to a soulmate. They clicked immediately. If you look at this, there was some kind of stupid film they did together. But my God, the chemistry those two have, sexual chemistry those two have, is stunning. It's almost embarrassing to watch them together. It is so close. But she was his equal.
Uh-huh.
She was also a star. She was also a musician. She was also an actress. She was considered a sex symbol for her time, and he couldn't stand it. His ego couldn't stand it. He had to go back to the 16-year-old girl who wasn't ever going to threaten him. And I have a tremendous respect for Priscilla, but at that time, she was a teenager. But apparently, when he died, not apparently, Anne Margaret wrote this in her biography, her husband, she married very happily and had a lifetime relationship with her husband until he died, like was married for like 40 years. He picked up the phone, and she said when the phone rang and he picked it up and said, oh, she screamed. She knew immediately Elvis was dead.
Mm.
So they kept this lifetime kind of sense of connection and love for each other. I think his whole thing of partnering with women who looked like him and insisting all the backup dancers have jet black hair, and he did everything in his power to get everybody around him to look like him. which is a very bizarre personality trait. The only thing I can think of is he always had the sense he was incomplete. He was always looking for that other half of himself.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's real armchair psychology, but it makes for fun novel writing in the sense that you've got this guy who I think came across as very sexual, very masculine, very confident. I think he was very wounded.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the vulnerable, wounded, tender Elvis that was interesting to me. He was apparently very respectful and nice to these Black women that toured with him. I think he would have said Miss Merrily and take, yeah, I think all that was probably legitimate. There was a little boy part of him that loved to have a mother figure around him. And I guess it's that part of Elvis that's more interesting to me than the person that picked up the gun and shot out the TV if he didn't like the news.
Right.
But he did also like go on stage with guns, loaded guns.
Yeah.
The story about a loaded gun flying out of his waistband and flying across the thing and the backup singers just kind of kicking it to the edge of the stage, that's pretty well documented. I didn't want him to be the black hole that the whole book sucked inside of. I wanted Honey and Corey Beth to be good characters too. But, you know, Elvis is a larger-than-life personality. It's hard to deny that. I've got to tell you this because this is a really funny story. This book was published by Gallery, which is a division of Simon & Schuster. And just when it was ready to go to press, it was finished, it was typeset, everything, it was ready to go to press. And they said, well, the lawyers for Simon & Schuster are a little worried, and they want to have it vetted by Graceland. I'm like, oh, no.
Oh, boy.
Because I'm like, okay, Graceland is notoriously, they love to litigate, they love to sue people. And I'm like, there is no way, because I flat out say he died of a drug overdose. Not that that's not well documented, but, you know, they might not like how he's portrayed in this book. Okay, so somebody at Graceland, I don't know who, read the book, and my editor calls me back laughing about 2 weeks later. She said, well, they want one change. I'm like, what is it? And at the beginning of the book, when Corey Beth first finds the car and she calls Graceland to tell him she's got the car, I said that a bored-sounding Graceland operator put her on hold. And they said a Graceland operator would never sound bored. She would meet every guest with enthusiasm and politeness.
Oh, my God.
And could I take out the words bored sounding? I'm like, they are out of there. That was their only objection.
That's amazing.
Is that not crazy, given what's in that book? There's so many things in that book they could have objected to, and they didn't like the fact I said the Graceland operator sounded bored.
Oh, my gosh. I had no idea you had to go through Graceland. I'm thinking about my novel, Searching for Jimmy Page. If Jimmy Page had to vet my book, it probably never would have come out.
No, can you imagine? Or the estate of somebody. That's even worse Then they really don't have a sense of humor about it.
Yes.
They're trying to protect this icon, which is, you know, I don't know.
That's hilarious that that's the change they wanted.
Yeah, I know.
I love in the book that you write about the people at Graceland shifting from trying to save Elvis the man on that fateful night in August 16th, 1977, to saving Elvis the idea. And that's what I mean about the myths and all of that kind of thing. Did you see that 2018 HBO documentary on Elvis called The Searcher?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a suggestion that he may have killed himself.
Yeah.
That was the first I'd ever heard of that in that 2018 documentary.
I mean, who knows? But let me tell you the reason I don't believe that.
Okay.
He didn't have Lisa Marie with him that often, and she was there that night. I don't think he would have killed himself when his daughter was there. He was, for his numerous and well-documented flaws, extremely family-oriented in his way. And he had her with him for a couple of weeks at a time, just a couple of times a year. I just can't see him choosing that time to kill himself.
Well, that's a good point. Lisa Marie has a slight presence in the novel.
Well, and then, see, she was alive at that point. I was really careful about Priscilla and Lisa Marie. They're real people. That seemed unfair to me. I mean, not that Elvis wasn't real, but he was at that point beyond Kim Wright's ability to embarrass or hurt him. And, you know, so I was careful about that. But she was very present that night and apparently showed up in the middle of it, confused, and one of the backup singers grabbed her and took her out. I can't see him putting a 9-year-old child through that.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. With the recent movies like Elvis and Priscilla, Elvis's influence on pop culture remains significant, nearly 50 years after his death. Have you seen those films?
Oh, yeah. I see them, and they always kind of make me sad because as more and more has come out about how much his hands were tied by the colonel and all that kind of stuff, it makes you really wonder, I mean, as talented and as great an artist as he was, what could he have been if there hadn't been so many restraints on him?
And I think to a degree, you touch on that in the novel. What direction would he have gone in? What was he thinking in terms of his musical interest at the end of his life?
Right. He almost had become a parody of himself, you know, stuffed into those white jumpsuits, overweight and sweating, and wiping himself with a thing and throwing it at an audience in Vegas. And that part makes me sad because when you see the young Elvis, he was truly electric.
Oh, yeah. I got the idea for this next bit from Peter McDade in his rock novel, The Weight of Sound. It's a game called Only Pick One.
Okay.
You can only pick one in each category I'm going to throw out.
Okay. I love games.
All right. Let's play the game. First category is music formats. There's an 8-track tape that plays a big role in the story, and I'm not going to say anything more about that. Now, of course, the 8-track tape has gone the way of beta tapes. Mm-hmm. Which of the following music formats do you prefer? Vinyl, cassettes, or CDs?
I always liked vinyl for a strange reason. I mean, I think purists like vinyl. But when I was growing up, I would play the same song on an album over and over and over again. And I just remember the excitement of lowering that needle right into that little indention before the cassette. And I just don't think clicking through. And you remember how 8-tracks, you'd have to wait until it came around again?
Yes.
Split between the, that was the biggest pain. And cassettes were kind of a pain. And my cassettes were always breaking. Or I could just remember myself with a pencil spooling those cassettes back together. And so there was something about vinyl that was just kind of pure. I mean, I don't know. So I guess I'll go with that.
Okay. I'm with you on that. Next category. Elvis music mentioned in the book. I know you're not an obsessive Elvis fan, but you do like his music. The following are Elvis songs that pop up in Last Ride to Graceland. Which is your favorite? We have Blue Suede Shoes, Love Me Tender, Jailhouse Rock, Hound Dog. And I'll throw in a gospel song, How Great Thou Art. What you picking?
Without any doubt, Jailhouse Rock. I am a competitive ballroom dancer, and I have actually danced a jive to Jailhouse Rock, and it is a freaking awesome song. And the video for Jailhouse Rock is a classic everyone should see.
Yeah, that's Elvis at his best.
To me, that's the Elvis that when I visualize him at his best, that it's in that striped shirt in that.
I think my favorite Elvis songs are Kentucky Rain, Burning Love, and Suspicious Minds, but I do love Mystery Train from the Sun Record days.
Yeah, I always really like Kentucky Rain, too. I think it's a beautiful song.
Next category, food mentioned in the book.
Okay, I've got to tell you something before I answer this. When I went on my book club tour for this, a lot of book clubs do food that is themed to the book.
Right.
I ate more peanut butter and bananas for about a year and a half of my life, to the point I thought, if I have to face another peanut butter banana-based dessert, I think I'm just going screaming into the streets. Okay. Let me compose myself. You tell me.
This is a Southern novel with Southern grub, some of which is famous because of its association with Elvis, including the sandwich that you just mentioned. Which of the following would you crave if you were on a road trip in the South? We have ribs, especially the kind like Mary Lee fixes. We have the Elvis milkshake. We have meatloaf with lima beans and mashed potatoes, which is what the character Dirk eats when he has lunch with Corey Beth. We have pan-fried chicken with okra and stewed tomatoes, which is what Corey Beth eats during that same lunch. And then finally, what you just mentioned, peanut butter and banana sandwich. Elvis's favorite. He also liked the peanut butter and bacon sandwich. Fried, of course. Which of those, I'm going to assume you're not going to choose the final one. Which would you choose?
I must be a true southerner because any of the four sound good to me. I am such a barbecue freak.
Me too.
I would definitely go with Beryl Lee and her barbecue, which I really enjoyed writing that part because Fairhope in Alabama is such a cute town, and it does have those restaurants that are up on the pilings kind of at the edge of the bay. And so, that to me would just be an atmospheric night standing out there with Meryl Lee's barbecue. That would be great. But there is an Elvis milkshake, and the first time I had it, bizarrely enough, was in Macon, Georgia, and it's got a bacon straw. It's good. It's a fun combination of stuff because you got the sweet and the salty in there. It's a thing. It's a thing. Everybody should have one once in their life.
So it's made with banana ice cream and peanut butter and that candied bacon straw?
Yep.
Holy cow.
Yep.
All right. I tried. Okay, final category. Drinks mentioned in the novel. It's a rock novel, Kim. We have to talk about booze.
Sure.
So this is the alcohol I logged in your book. And I know at least one of these options has got to be tempting because you've been drinking red wine and I've been drinking white wine throughout this interview.
It's Friday afternoon.
Yes, absolutely. So here are your options. Beer, peach daiquiri. Corey's mom wasn't much of a drinker. When she did drink, she'd order something like that. Wine coolers. The backup singers living at Graceland got bored. Elvis was away and they're running around the mansion drinking wine coolers out of coffee mugs. We have Almaden wine, and I'm not going to even explain that because it's an important scene, I think. We have bourbon. Corey's singing voice is described as Delta dirty bourbon-soaked sound. And then we have Jack Daniels, Elvis, and another character knocked back some pills with some Jack at one point. So pick your poison.
My poison would be the Jack minus the pills. I'm not quite as rock and roll as Elvis. I can handle the Jack. I'm going to say, I mean, to me, like a peach daiquiri, and I stole this from my own mother. She actually said, you didn't base this person on me, did you? My own mother would not drink, but she would get a peach daiquiri. She was like, oh, it's time for a peach. So I think of a peach daiquiri as what people who don't drink drink. So, you know, and the wine coolers and the coffee mugs, I just thought that was funny. It was such a 70s thing. You know how everybody would get the 70s. And have you ever had Almaden wine? It is a dreadful thing.
No, I'd never heard of it before.
Well, it's because you're younger than me. It's a 70s type of wine. We would drink like Blue Nun and Almaden. Truly dreadful stuff. I'm ashamed. It's the shame of my youth of what I drink. But I will proudly have a pop of Jack Daniels any day of the week.
Okay. All right.
So this makes me sound very hardcore. I love this quiz because I sound very gangster with my vinyl and my vinyl and my ribs and my Jack Daniels. I think I sound way more interesting than I really am.
And you got it going on, girl. Oh, Kim, this has been so much fun. Thank you for joining me.
Well, I really enjoyed it. And it's always so much fun to talk about Elvis in the South and ribs and Jack Daniels and music. So I will happily talk about any of those anytime you want.
Well, what you got going on now you want to tell folks about?
Well, I am actually right now working on a book about the origins of shag, which kind of takes me back to some of the Elvis stuff, kind of a blend of black and white music at a period of time that I really love to look into, which is the early 60s. I think it's absolutely fascinating. Like this book is set in 62 and I'm working on it. I've done a historical book, which I am presently finishing up, which is called Marguerite, which is set in 14th century France. So it's a real departure for me. So I've got two now. One is collaboration and one that I'm finishing, which is a little departure because it's true historical fiction.
I heard you on a podcast once tell the host that you had thought about writing a sequel to Last Ride to Graceland. Any progress on that?
I actually gave up that idea because I like where I ended that book.
I do too. I was wondering, what's she going to do with this?
Just because the book was popular, my agent and editor both wanted me to write one. But I don't know, the more I thought about it, the more I really liked where that book ended.
Okay, well, keep me posted. If you change your mind, I'll be interested to know about that.
Well, what do you do? After you say last ride to Graceland, what do you do say? I was kidding, one more ride. What kind of title is that? That's not a good title.
Oh, well.
Forget it. We're circling Graceland again. I just don't think so.
Okay, yeah. I think you might be done. You might be done on that.
I'm done with that. I'm moving on.
Well, where can folks go to find out more about you and buy your books?
Well, my books are available. I mean, you can always have them ordered through bookstores. They're all available on Amazon. And my website is kimwright.org.
Fabulous. I will put links in the show notes. Thanks again.
Okay. Thank you so much, Chrissy. This was fun.
We'll take another short break, then we'll be back with Song Facts podcast host Stephanie Myers and Rock is Lit Season 3 production intern Cater Jones to talk about some of the real-life people who, like Corey Beth in Kim's novel, think Elvis Presley is their daddy.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out. Because I love you too much, baby. Why can't you see what you're doing to me when you don't believe?
This is Stephanie Myers, and you're listening to Rock is Lit.
So this segment was inspired by Kim Wright's rock novel, Last Ride to Graceland, about a young woman who takes a road trip from Beaufort, South Carolina to Graceland in Memphis, Tennessee, because she thinks Elvis Presley might be her father. When I was planning this episode and the interview with Kim Wright, I got to thinking, I doubt that her fictional character is the only person who's ever wondered if the king might be their daddy. Elvis was no angel. So I asked Cater to do some research, and he came up with a ton of information. Some of it I was already familiar with. A lot of it I had never heard of before. Now, this is not the first Elvis-inspired episode I've done. The third episode of Rock is Lit featured Chris Charlesworth in his novel, Caught in a Trap, The Kidnapping of Elvis. Stephanie joined me on that episode, and we talked about actual kidnapping plots involving Elvis. And that was a lot of fun, so I thought, you know, makes sense for you to come back and join us on this Elvis episode. So thanks for being a repeat offender.
Yeah, happy to be here. I'll give the caveat that a lot of this is just like me speculating.
Yeah.
I don't want the Elvis estate to come after me.
They're angry. Yeah, though.
And litigious. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't know. I'm happy to kind of just roll with it and give my take.
And that information's out there. So we're only repeating what's already out there. Nobody's pulled anything out of their ass. So it's
as a former journalist, I'm all about giving the caveat and, you know, letting people make their own conclusions.
Okay, duly noted. Before we get started, here's a little background to set the stage. We all know Elvis was married to Priscilla. They had one child, Lisa Marie, who died January 2023. And I still can't wrap my head around that. But Elvis dated a lot of women, including Natalie Wood, Anne Margaret, whom he met on the set of Viva Las Vegas, Connie Stevens, Sybil Shepherd, Peggy Lipton from the Mod Squad, Rita Moreno, who apparently just wanted to make Marlon Brando jealous. And then there were the girlfriends like Linda Thompson, Anita Wood, whom he dated in the 50s, and Ginger Alden. He was engaged to her at the time of his death. But there are scads of other women, you know, women that he picked up on the road, one night stands, what have you. So it's no surprise that these stories have cropped up about Elvis having more than just one child. Now, Cater, you mentioned that there was a 2016 National Enquirer exhaustive investigation into this very thing. Tell us a little bit about that.
I was actually surprised that the National Enquirer had the courage to say all of this, because they were claiming DNA evidence and evidence that Elvis was financially supporting these children from afar. So they were saying he had full knowledge of most of these children. I think they claimed about 8 of them. And said that they were getting money from him and that all of these suspicions were accurate. It's a lot of interesting characters in there and a lot of varying levels of possibility.
Well, you know, it's in the National Enquirer, so it's got to be true.
Right.
You mentioned that there are eight people that article or that investigation covered, three that we're going to talk in depth about. Stephanie, can you just kind of give us an overview, a real quick overview of the five people that we're not going to talk about in depth?
Yeah, so it's so interesting because I feel like, as you say, Cater, there's these different levels of folks come out of the woodwork over the years. There's Candy Jo Fuller, Dieter, Leroy Kuzma, John D. Smith Presley, and Elvis Jr. And these are all pretty prominent folks, just prominent claims over the years that have come through. But yeah, interesting about kind of the three that we're going to focus on too, because they got their own stories and they're kind of crazy stories.
Isn't one of them dead?
Yeah,
Leroy Kuzma is dead. Yeah.
Yeah, there's all these very similar aspects to these stories. And I want to talk about that later, some of the threads that run through these stories. But let's do a deep dive into three of these people. The first one we're going to talk about is Deborah, I don't know if I'm going to say her middle name right, Givone Presley, a.k.a. Deborah Presley Brando. Now, I don't know about you guys, but when I read Brando, that got my attention. So what's the deal with her, Cater?
Well, she got that last name because she's a former actress living in Los Angeles and was once married to Marlon Brando's late son, Christian Brando. And her story is that she claims her mom had an intense 2-year relationship when Deborah met Elvis.
You mean her mom?
Yeah, that's right. She met Elvis when she was 14 years old, back when he was an unknown musician at a recording studio in Charlotte, North Carolina. You'll notice a common theme among the mothers of the supposed love children is that they often claim to have met him before he got famous. And because he was less documented before he was famous, it gets hard to prove the
logistics.
Well,
that's convenient.
Yeah, it is very convenient. Anyway, Barbara gave birth to Deborah. And as Deborah grew up, hearing her mom's stories about her involvement with Elvis during the 50s, Deborah eventually built up the courage to ask if Elvis was her father. And her mom said yes. And almost immediately after this, Deborah went to court, declared herself the legal heir, and demanded half of his estate.
How did the estate react to that?
Well, the court made a very interesting ruling, which was only Elvis's children born in wedlock are entitled to his assets.
Uh-huh.
So it's very interesting how they worded it, and it got a lot of people questioning the verdict because they didn't outwardly deny Deborah's relation to Elvis Presley. In fact, the way they worded it almost sounded like they were confirming her suspicions. My theory is that they worded the ruling this way to set a precedent for any future Elvis children cases, because we were already in 89, we were already seeing a string of love children making public statements and claiming. So this would kind of nip that in the bud. So that's an important story in the Elvis Love Children canon. Deborah also wrote a book about this, and her book was called Starseed. You'll notice that nearly every love child has written a book.
I like what you said about setting a precedent with that ruling, but it does kind of leave the door open for someone to question if the estate is acknowledging not just this particular person, but the possibility that he could have some illegitimate kids out there.
Right.
It's an interesting way to word that.
Treat me like a fool. Treat me mean and cruel. But love me. Bring my faithful heart. Tear it off.
Won't you love me?
If you ever
Okay, Stephanie, moving on to the next love child. This person's name is Lisa Johansson. What do we know about Lisa?
Yeah, Lisa's an interesting case for sure. People say that she remains one of Elvis's most bizarre mysteries. She lives in Florida to this day, has a law degree. She's a married mother of four. And her very interesting claim is that she was spirited out of Graceland after Elvis died in August 1977. She said, "I was spirited out for security reasons when I was 9 years old." And then this part was a very bizarre twist. She says, "was taken to Sweden and replaced by an imposter who later became Lisa Marie."
Oh my God.
That's a pretty specific claim and a little bit wild. So she had been photographed with Priscilla's late brother, Tom, in another photo. So the National Enquirer has claimed this photo to be, it's like, okay, this is evidence. But it's been also noted that the Elvis clan family makes themselves available for fans. They love to meet them. So this photo, it's like, here's brother, here's Priscilla, Priscilla's mother. It feels like that's not a claim that's going to hold up in court. I just keep going back to the crazy part about saying, yeah, I was spirited away to Sweden. It's like, oh, okay. And then you look at her photo and flip side of that is she looks just like Elvis. So,
yeah,
you know, I think there's a lot of mysteries with somebody who's a huge icon like this, and some things we'll never know. And maybe we're not meant to know.
Now, did she write a book? This person write a book too? Do we know?
She did. And she even wrote the book under the name Lisa Marie Presley.
Which, no.
Yeah. It's called I, Lisa Marie. Right. She gets a lot of news attention in Sweden for being this character. She even has a section of the book about her facial structure and using scientific facial analyzation to compare her face with Elvis's face. She does look a lot like Elvis, but the whole idea that Priscilla Presley would abandon her child in Sweden and replace her with a random child for security reasons makes it hard to believe.
I'm interested in the legalities. How could she publish a book under the name Lisa Marie Presley and the estate not come after her?
I think the estate has reached out to her a lot. In fact, she sued the estate because the lawyer for the Presley sent her apparently a very angry letter, and she sued him for libel and emotional damages.
Oh, okay. So she's alive and well and still living in Sweden?
I assume so. There's not a lot of information on many of these people about what happened after they came out about Elvis. In fact, like, it's very hard to find information about where they are now, besides maybe Desiree.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that heartbreak hotel where I'll be just a lonely baby. Well, I'm so lonely, I'll be just so lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom.
Desiree Presley. Stephanie, had you ever heard of her before? Because she's the only one on this list that I've heard of.
Yeah, I'd heard the name. And, you know, to me, the first thing is like, oh, she's literally using the last name. Wow. But she's been doing it for a long time. For folks who don't know, she's considered the foremost likely and famous love child. Her mother wrote a book, her mother, Lucy DeBarbin, about her affair with Elvis and Desiree being their alleged child, called Are You Lonesome Tonight? The Untold Story of Elvis Presley's One True Love and the Child He Never Knew. Wow, to call herself Elvis's One True Love, by the way, that's that's a big claim. That's a big claim. She co-wrote that book with a former Miami News reporter, Derry Matura. What was interesting to me, especially as a former journalist, was like Matura said, okay, well, could this be real? I have some doubts if this is real. And then he met Desiree, was like,
oh my God, looks so much like Elvis. And then said, oh, I was able to look up every word, said every word, no matter what she said, I was able to verify with somebody. That's something. Her mom, DeBarbin, says, I met Elvis in 1953 near Shreveport, Louisiana. She was 16, yeah. And we know Elvis did like teenagers. Said it was very early in his career. So, yeah, it's interesting because Desiree, yeah, lists her birth certificate. Her father's Randolph Presley, civil engineer, but obviously she's capitalizing in a different way here. Maybe capitalizing is too strong of a term, but she's in the public eye under her own circumstances for her own reason. So it's kind of fascinating how she's parlayed this. But it was in 1987 when the Orlando Sentinel reported that Desiree could be a love child of Elvis. So she's gotten press coverage for her claims. And to my knowledge, she's kept that particular story over the years. Of course, Graceland says this book is ridiculous and incredible. We're not dignifying the matter by responding with further comments, which is, I think, the only thing Graceland could do in something like this. But yeah, it's interesting that she's continued to get this coverage over the years, right?
Yeah, I read that book. This was at the height of the Elvis is Alive craze.
Yeah.
And that book came out in 87, and I read it either right when it came out or the next year. I was 17 or 18 years old when I read that. I remember seeing her mother and Desiree on Donahue. Oh, so they really got a lot of mainstream media with that claim in that book.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother died some years ago. Yeah, if you look at Desiree, of all these people that Cater got pictures of that we've been talking about, she looks the most like him. This is the only one that I think, I don't know, maybe that's the only one that I think there's any possibility that it could be true.
I think the fact that she looks like him gave the story a lot more credence to the public. And the fact that she wrote a book about it and went very into detail about it and made these big, bold claims.
You mentioned some patterns before, like people making these claims before he got famous. Did you see anything else that you thought were threads between that linked the stories?
Well, a lot of these claims were made pretty soon after Elvis's death, which is significant. Desiree's mom claimed that she had kept Elvis's paternity a secret from him until about a couple days before he died, when she hinted at a possible child. There's a couple other parents that came forward with this. Candy Jo Fuller's mom came forward after he died to reveal this to the public. So that's a common thread. Another common thread that we brought up is that many of these mothers were underage when they met him.
Several of these people who claim to be Elvis's kids are country singers, like the Candy Jo Fuller is a former country singer. John D. Smith Presley is a country singer from Scottsdale, Arizona. And he's another one claiming to have DNA evidence that Elvis was his father. And also wrote a book, Let the Boy Sing, Elvis is My Daddy.
That's my favorite.
That's my favorite too. I might have to read that book. Oh, and this is a great one too. The Elvis Jr. guy is an Elvis impersonator.
Mm-hmm.
So looks like he took his job a little bit too seriously.
Especially from those photos that I've seen. It's like, okay, yeah I'm going to do almost an Elvis Halloween costume. Looks like what you guys doing. So.
Maybe I didn't treat you quite as good as I should have. Maybe I didn't love you quite as often as I could have. Little things I should have said and done, I just never took the time. You were always on my mind.
Okay, well, all this is interesting. Anybody have any final words about Elvis's love children?
With a caveat that it's pure speculation on my part, I think there's probably Love Children Velvas that have never come forward at all, honestly, in all likelihood.
Yeah.
Yeah. And those are probably the actual Love Children, the ones who just want to keep this under wraps. Yeah.
The ones that got paid off by the Presley estate. keep exactly. It shut.
Keep it.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thing that keeps these rumors and stories of illegitimate children going is that it's not out of the realm of possibility for him.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's really what gets people excited about this. And I would encourage anyone who's interested to look up some of the articles and some of the pictures, because it's just a lot of characters and it's super interesting to read about.
Yes, and Elvis Presley Estate, if you're listening, we are not endorsing anybody. We are merely putting this out there, and it's actually already out there. So
already out there.
You know, peace out. No harm intended here. Thanks so much, Stephanie, for coming back on the show. Next time
Absolutely.
I do another Elvis book, I'll hit you up again. But what have you got going on that you want to tell folks about?
Yeah, I am a new host of Song Facts podcast, also here on the Pantheon Music Network. I get to interview really fun and great musicians, songwriters. I encourage folks to take a look at that. And then we've got Stephanie and Stephanie Talk Tunes, which is going to sunset for at least a little while in May. Yeah, check those out if you haven't already. Super appreciate each and every listen, honestly.
And Cater, thank you so much for all the research that you did and for joining this episode, and happy graduation.
Thanks, Christy.
Happy graduation.
Yeah, thanks.
And a final thank you to Kim Wright for writing such a wonderful novel in Last Ride to Graceland. You can find that at your local indie bookstore or wherever you buy books.
Well, it's hard to be a gambler, betting on the number that changes every time. When you think you're gonna win, you think she's giving in. A stranger's all you find. Yeah, it's hard to figure out what she's all about, but she's woman through and through. She's a complicated lady, so call her my baby.
Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis has left the building. Thank you and good night.
Rock is lit.